This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Information about who and what we are, predicated on our ability to interact with each other in our environment, our ability to recall past experiences or form new memories, our ability to learn, and our ability to perceive the world through our senses or form habits are now clearly understood to be due to the communication between individual neurons and networks of neurons in and across different brain regions. Good evening. My name is Gentry Patrick, and I am a neuroscientist. Specifically, I am a professor in the neurobiology section of the Division of Biological Sciences at UC San Diego, where I run an active research lab, teaching and training undergraduates, graduate students, and postdocs. I am not only a neuroscientist, however, I'm also someone who cares and thinks deeply about awareness, knowledge, access, and success of our underserved communities in STEM. In fact, I maintain that the STEM and healthcare profession pipeline is a social justice issue and a human health issue, one that requires empathy, compassion, and action to solve. There are many reasons why I'm here today, such as hard work paired with luck, a young mother who sacrificed for me, teachers who recognized my potential, mentors and advocates, finding my love of science, indeed my STEM identity, my ability to communicate my passion for science, my core belief that STEM is for all, and resisting against the notion that I am an anomaly. But let me begin with Gentry, the scientist. Synapses are the point of contact and communication between two neurons. Synaptic transmission is a process where chemical signals, known as neurotransmitters, are released from one cell and are bound by neurotransmitter receptors on a receiving cell, which activates that cell. Synaptic plasticity is a selective strengthening and weakening of synapses in response to past experience, an activity which is fundamental to all brain processes, such as the ability to learn, form memories, or modify behavior. In contrast, impairments in synaptic plasticity are considered to contribute to neurological and neurodegenerative disorders. So here's a fun fact. The human brain has literally billions of neurons and trillions of synapses, making the computational power of the brain astronomical, with estimates that an adult human brain carries out about 1,000 trillion logical operations per second. Communications at synapses, as I mentioned, can be strengthened or weakened. Here is a cross-section in a diagram form of the hippocampus, a major brain structure studied in memory formation. We can stimulate the axons in one region of the hippocampus and then record the responses in another region. However, if we stimulate the slice in a specific manner, we can elicit a change, as shown here, where the same test stimulus now gives rise to a stronger or weaker response, also known as potentiation or depression. And the ability to weaken or strengthen communication at individual synapses, as shown here in this transmission electron micrograph, is fundamental to brain function in both health and disease. So as it turns out, synaptic plasticity is accompanied by changes in the protein composition of synapses. And over the last 16 and a half years, my lab has been interested in the molecular mechanisms of synaptic plasticity, indeed the molecular makeup of synapses, with a particular interest in how proteins are made and degraded at synapses. For instance, glutamate neurotransmitter receptors, which bind glutamate, they mediate the large majority of excitatory neurotransmission in our brains. They just so happen to be located on the postsynaptic side of the synapse, the receiving end. My lab discovered a specific pathway which removes glutamate receptors from synapses during normal neuronal physiology, as well as in Alzheimer's disease. And we hope that with a better understanding of this receptor degradation pathway, we might identify key pathways and proteins that can be targeted therapeutically in Alzheimer's disease. The Patrick Lab uses several experimental strategies, including molecular biology, biochemistry, transgenic mice, electrophysiology, and both static and live imaging to understand protein turnover at synapses. Here's an image of a hippocampal neuron in culture expressing a genetically encoded fluorescent molecule, such as green fluorescent protein. To evaluate the changes in the number or shape of dendritic spines where excitatory synapses can be found. Or perhaps in live imaging, where we fuse green fluorescent protein to another protein that highlights how a special degradative organelle called the lysosome moves around in neurons as they degrade glutamate receptors in both health and Alzheimer's disease. Imaging is not only facilitates our research, but also generates beautiful imagery for the cover of journals to highlight our work. So with that brief introduction of my science, let me give you a few takeaways about Gentry, the scientist. Communication at neurons takes place at synapses, which can be strengthened or weakened. That's also known as synaptic plasticity. The Patrick Lab studies the turnover of proteins at synapses, in particular glutamate receptors, in both health and disease. And importantly, I absolutely love science, and I'm a big science nerd. My lab is located on the Revell campus of UC San Diego. And after 16 and a half years, I've had the privilege to work with many high school students, undergraduate students, graduate students, postdoctoral fellows, and numerous faculty and research collaborators. But how did this all happen? Here's a bit about my academic journey. I was born in South Central Los Angeles to a single mother of age 16 and was the first to attend college in my family. And if some of you may know, growing up in Compton and Watts during the 70s and 80s posed a particular challenge to young Black men. During my formative years and with little means, my mother did the best she could for me to keep me healthy, safe, and make sure I had access to the best education she could provide, and to instill in me a passion to do something good with my life, to be a leader. While she died at a very young age of 37, she impressed upon me to use education as a means to achieve my goals. I followed that path the best way I could, but there were some hurdles. In fact, until I began to get much needed mentorship by a few faculty and advocates, it was very tough. Gaining access to a research laboratory while an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, initially washing dishware, and eventually becoming an active member of a laboratory, kickstarted my sincere interest in science as a possible profession. Indeed, my STEM identity was beginning to find its roots. After completing my master's in biochemistry and biophysics at UCSF, I went on to complete a PhD in neuroscience at Harvard University and postdoctoral training at Caltech prior to joining the neurobiology faculty at UC San Diego in 2004. Eventually to become a tenured professor in 2011 and a full professor in 2017. My research has uncovered key pathways to understand the molecular makeup and modification of synapses in the brain in both health and disease. And during my time here at UC San Diego, I've taught thousands of undergraduates and trained several graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, and partnered with numerous individuals on campus and in the community to create innovative programs and pathways in STEM for students from underserved communities just like my own. So you may be wondering, how does a kid from Compton, California embark on a life journey and successful academic and career path to full professor in neurobiology at UC San Diego? The answer is simple: access, mentorship, and advocacy. This is an important part of my message to you all today. In 2018, I wanted to start a STEM success program for underserved that would rival nepotism. I started Pathways to STEM through Enhanced Access and Mentorship Program at UC San Diego, also known as the PATH Scholars Program. And I could not do this alone. It took a village of advocates and facilitators, and most importantly, a community ready for change. For qualified applicants for the PATHS program, you must be an incoming freshman in a STEM major at UC San Diego, although we now look to pathways for transfer students in our program. You must have an exceptional commitment to character, culture, and community, and be a resident of an underrepresented and under-resourced community. The program has many benefits: a four-year scholarship of up to $10,000 per year, personalized academic support, pre-matriculation summer bridge program, high-touch mentorship, summer research and internship opportunities, and importantly, a cohort experience to share and support your academic journey with others. We have many campus partners. And some of them are listed here, as you can see. What we do is we take a holistic approach for the personal, academic, financial, and community-based support of our scholars. And this includes a lot of different things as indicated here: academic support, stratified mentorship, identity exploration, targeted advising, laboratory training, internship and research, professional preparation. This is just the beginning. This is really a community, a family that we built. We also have many community and philanthropic partners, as shown here, some of which took a chance on us in the very beginning. We also are very fortunate to have found a partner in the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, also known as CZI, where Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg have provided us substantial support for a collaborative partnership to increase diversity in STEM at both UC San Diego and UC Berkeley. While this has required partnership from many, including, as you might imagine, philanthropy, community organizations, academia, STEM industry, local government, and the K-12 and pre-collegiate education pathway. Our number one partner is, of course, the student. So here is a few takeaways about Gentry, the advocate and mentor. First of all, you must know that I still absolutely love science and I'm a big science nerd. Providing access, mentorship, and advocacy are crucial. I believe the student is our number one partner, and there is a power in storytelling. We must help our underserved youth find and tell their own stories. I want to leave you with some words from our actual scholars. And this was from our first cohort a couple years ago. So I'll leave them with you.
Hi, my name is Deka Ismail. I'm from East San Diego, specifically the City Heights area.
Hi, my name is Hania Jawahiri. I'm pursuing human biology major at UCSD Marshall College.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Moreno, and I'm a P1 PATH scholar.
Hi, my name is Beth Corona, and I'm from San Diego, California.
Hi, my name is Rolando, and I'm a visually impaired first-generation college student here at UC San Diego, and I'm interested in studying the intersection between STEM and human behaviors.
My two parents are from Mexico. They immigrated from Mexico to the U.S., and my career goal is to become a pediatrician.
My ultimate goal is to become a chemist, but overall, I would like to bridge a gap between the sciences and public policy.
My future goal is to become a radiologist, and I'm planning for medical school.
You know, future career goal is to be my own personal PI, have my own lab, and do research in neurodegenerative diseases.
The title of a scholar means that you try your best to accomplish your goals. And even though you may confront challenges, you don't give up and you ask for help.
Scholar means to me earning by the hard work you do.
To me, the word scholar means to be a leader and to ask good questions. Through these questions, you can catalyze change in and outside of the classroom.
Somebody who is an activist, somebody who is strong and believes in what they say is, and cares about the community, and also is caring about bettering themselves and becoming a better person.
You are a role model for your community, for your neighbors, because your neighbors can be students like you who want to apply to college.
Being a scholar to me means not accepting the textbook answer and constantly questioning and constantly looking for solutions or multiple solutions. And being on a campus like UCSD here, there's so much different perspectives and new insights, and you could take that and be innovative.
Okay, I look forward to our discussion. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for that, Gentry. That was a great, clear introduction to some important problems here. So, Gentry, before we get to those questions, I wanted to highlight a sort of a high-level picture of what I heard from your talk and be interested in your thoughts on this. So there's a very strong argument for aiming for engaging underrepresented groups, underserved groups in STEM disciplines. That is an argument for fairness, an argument for social justice, and it just seems to be the right thing to do. And I could see that argument, but there's also an argument that engaging those groups is also beneficial to science. If we don't have them engaged, then we are losing something. So are those two goals different goals, or are they in fact the same goal?
I think they are intertwined. I think they bridge each other. Indeed, you might say it's just the right thing to do, that we need to make sure that we're including everyone. But you can look at today's world right now and wonder how we're going to deal with a pandemic that's affecting the entire world. And by not having others, you know, marginalized groups who may have had access or an understanding, the ability to trust, say, the scientific community, you have issues that are quite prevalent right now. I know that lots of Black and brown communities are, you know, it's been a struggle to make sure that they see and understand that, you know, COVID vaccine, for instance, or to trust the system in general, if they have not been included throughout this entire time, right? So I think when you have representatives from all walks of life and from all communities, everyone is pitching in their ideas and sitting at the table and beginning to break down the barriers. Sometimes it's a barrier of actually communication, a barrier of language, even though we're speaking the same language, but we're not really leaning in with an ability to make sure that we carefully understand and actually the word I'm thinking of is respect all of those views, respect all of those paths and all of those lived experiences that are out there.
Yeah, so, you know, in that respect, no pun intended. It seems to me that when I look at your research, you are showing an example that we see often in research now, that the best research is research that is highly collaborative, cross-disciplinary, multidisciplinary. And I presume the reason for that is because we recognize that calling on those different techniques and approaches means that we have a far richer chance of being able to achieve our goals. And it seems to me that that parallels very well the argument that the very people that you have working in your research need to also come from diverse backgrounds. Is that a fair way to compare what we're talking about?
Yeah, so I would say that, the first thing that came to my mind when you first started talking about this particular point is what drew me to science. What drew me to science was the fact that, first of all, it was exciting. I had a lot of curiosity, and I could plant that curiosity, even if I didn't know what I was doing, in a lab around people who I didn't know or had different backgrounds, but we all had a common interest. And for me, that was a draw to be able to learn from others. I will say, though, that over time, it's taken a bit of time to have that reciprocal feedback or engagement from the scientific community. I think I've been accepted in the scientific community because I've worked hard and I've been successful. But it's just now that I think that I'm actually beginning to have my voice about who I really am, where I come from, and why I care about helping others that have come from backgrounds like myself. I had to learn the language of science. I had to learn the language and the community of science. It did not look like me. I could definitely say that, I'm pretty sure that most people didn't have the same trajectory or background that I had. So as opposed to having a life that was full of assimilating, I think that what we should be doing is making sure that everyone's voice, everyone's background and lived experience, again, is something that we value. And I think that it will allow, I think it actually will drive innovation in science. We will get places faster because we will have everyone contributing.
That's the line I was thinking that I see here, that I was hearing from you, but it also raises a challenging question. So if diversifying the scientific enterprise in terms of representation had no benefit for science, let's for a moment assume that were the case, would it be sufficient to argue that we should just do this based on fairness? I think you can answer yes, but I'll let you speak to that a bit. Should we?
Yes, I would. Yeah, I mean, you could say yes, that based on fairness, but yeah. We see it all around us. We're going to have challenges in science that we still don't know the answers to. Whether it be, public health crisis like the pandemic, whether it be various diseases and disorders that affect us all, but affect us maybe in different ways. And without including those individuals, not only in the studies, right? It goes to say, right, this is why in NIH now we make sure that we attend to differences in sex. We don't just work on the same type of male rat, for instance, if you're a neuroscientist. You know, we have to think about these things. I also think that we really want to... If we want to solve big challenges, then we have to represent or find the connection to the community that we come from. Science does not sit isolated in a vacuum. we are individuals from different backgrounds. And when I think about the STEM industry and the STEM pathway, the fact that there are very few black and brown individuals that are going along this path, I see that we're missing the boat. We're missing out on opportunities for individuals to contribute. And that's also a connection, that's a social justice and social justice issue, and that's a human health issue, as I mentioned in my the preamble kind of talk before we started our discussion. I do believe that the STEM and human STEM and healthcare professions pipeline is a it really is a social justice issue, because if we don't, I mean, we can just look at it. Maybe people don't realize what's happening around them. There are people who are suffering. They lack of adequate health care, lack of adequate education, lack of trust of different communities, an inability to communicate across those community divides, whether they be racial or socioeconomical. Science has to be a part of that. We, you know, we don't just do science just for science. I do science because I care about the individuals around me. And that's why I also don't think about at the end of the day, and I'll stop with this, what have I done all by myself? I love doing science because it's very collaborative. I love doing science because I can teach someone else about it, because one day I'm going to be gone and just, you know, maybe a few words in a textbook. You know, I would hope that I've impacted, you know, human lives more than just, say, a simple discovery that I've had. Although I know some people would say, you know, we're here for a certain period of time, we make discoveries, we can impact, you know, human lives tremendously. But for me, I think that it really is an ability to have science connect with the community in a larger way.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I want to talk a bit about that collaborative aspect you just mentioned. However, one of the things we want to do from that collaborative perspective, the Ethics Center has moved, as so many programs have, to an online format over the past year. And in doing so, we've lost the opportunity that we had in the past for the audience to be more collaborative, to speak with one another, to see one another. And tonight we're trying an experiment where we can use breakout rooms that will allow us to model what we do in person, hopefully as good or better than we normally do. We're going to do our best to hear from the groups and perhaps turn to the chat and Q&A to have a conversation here between our speaker, Dr. Patrick, and you. Let's start with the groups that looked at the first question, which is, do you agree that people of color are dramatically underrepresented in STEM disciplines? And I'm going to start with group four. Did you choose a spokesperson? Could somebody let us know your perspective on this question, where your discussion went?
Yes, I was in group four.
Okay, thank you, Aaron. So can you tell us what you guys came up with on this question?
Right. So the question is, are people of color dramatically underrepresented? We pretty much agree that yes, and it's happened for a pretty large number of reasons. We went over just a few of them. One of them is that there's a lot of space taken up disproportionately by like more privileged people and white people especially. Also there, when students of color end up in these elevated positions, there's often still a disparity. You know, for example, one of the other people in my group mentioned that they have a mentor at their school, but there isn't that same, struggle because their mentor doesn't relate to that struggle that she goes through as a person of color in STEM. And there's also a lot of disparity that even draws back to before the undergraduate experience. Certain high schools have access to things that a lot of high schools that are predominantly minorities don't have. I can speak to this with personal experience because I know some high schools around the area that I lived in had access to things like large computer labs and coding classes and things like that, whereas my high school didn't. And we were mostly Black and brown in my high school. So yeah, I might have rambled on a little bit, but there are a lot of reasons, and it's a lot of things that we have to address both separately and together.
Yeah, so that was very nice. Gentry, maybe you want to respond to a couple of those things.
I want to add to that. Thank you, Aaron. I think that's what we're here and what we're talking about right now. You know, this is part of the message that I find very important to sit with and lean into. The fact that we don't have Black and brown scientists or doctors or people in the STEM industry in large numbers, because we have not been there before. You know, it has been taken up, the air in the room or the space has been kind of taken up by others, mainly white men. And so if you don't see yourself, if there's not a representative that looks like you, whether that be conscious or unconscious, there's going to be a disconnect or a huge threshold to overcome to see yourself in that place. I did not go on my trajectory and say, you know what, one day I want to get a job at UCSD and be a full professor. I can understand how someone could say, you know, we might not know anywhere where no one can know what they're going to do with their lives. But when you don't have examples, it's even harder, right? No one in my family knows about STEM and, you know, the healthcare profession. So that's a real challenge. And so that's why we need more representation.
Yeah. So half of what I heard from Aaron, which you know, seemed like some really important points. One is talking about mentors who really didn't know the experience of the people they were mentoring. And the other was the lack of resources in the schools. In other words, the people that you might want to see moving into STEM disciplines don't have what they need. So those are two areas of lack. I mean, two pieces that are missing. I guess there's an interesting question here. If that's missing, then do we solve the problem by moving those people into STEM disciplines anyway? Or is our real problem to first solve the missing components that aren't there?
I think you have to do both, right?
Okay.
You have to do both. You have to, students aren't gonna find their love of science or find their will and persistence in STEM and science if they're not championed and if there's not an advocate, if there's not a reiterative method that keeps that STEM identity growing, for instance. You know, on the other hand, we need to find innovative ways where the STEM community right now is making more space and making more pathways and making more opportunities for people to rise up through the ranks to have more representation. Because while everyone can be an ally, everyone can be an advocate, we still need to make sure that the young student coming through the ranks is also seeing themselves in those positions. And so we do need more representation.
Yeah. So you have this chicken and egg problem. We need to work on both at the same time is what you're saying. It makes sense. Why don't we move on to question two, because I think we've highlighted some of the issues here. So question two is, would it be better if people of color were represented appropriately in STEM disciplines? We know that Gentry has that answer. And if yes, then what would be the advantages? And that's really what we want to get to. So I'd like to try and start with group two. Luca or Vera, can you speak up about what your group discussed?
Yes, well, of course. I was a female in engineering when I started out in engineering, however many years ago. So definitely we need, you know, I didn't see any other women in engineering when I started. So of course you want to see other people of color, because they don't have, like he was saying, don't have examples of other doctors or lawyers or engineers or whatever to aspire to. And I have been also volunteering with an organization that supplies books to children with the characters in the books are people of color. So they have someone that they can see in the books that look like them. I think the biggest problem, though, is one of the biggest problems is that the people don't necessarily know what the opportunities are out there. All the options, all the opportunities. So I think that they need to start from a young age with the parents, not telling kids what the options are, and so to steer them in the right direction. If they don't even know that opportunity is out there, they're not going to know to ask for it.
So Vera, in terms of focusing on the advantages part, so that's an interesting twist on this to say that one of the advantages to having people in these positions in STEM disciplines is that they will be a signal to others of the same color, of the same background, that you too could be here. And that's an important advantage that's kind of a meta advantage. But are there other advantages to the science? Did you discuss anything like that from having more diverse representation?
Well, of course, more minds working on different inventions or cures or whatever is better. And people of color have just as brilliant minds as people that are white. So we're missing that piece of the puzzle if they're not out there making inventions or cures or, aiding society in some way. Versus the school to prison pipeline. We don't want that. So anyway, maybe, and hopefully some of them will go back to their neighborhood, and help their neighborhood with health or education or, infrastructure or whatever is needed in there. But, and then again, their people in the community will see that a person of color can be successful as well.
I think that this is one of the hardest points, and to actually, the first thing is, if not, why not, right? I think the STEM community, science, it changes very slowly, right? And so it's hard to see the benefit of more abrupt or faster change. The altruistic, we want to be, equal and support everyone, and we want to help communities. That's there, but there are definitely, we can look to examples where a diversity in thought, a diversity in experience, a diversity in being able to deal with problems or having grit and resilience, diversity and all of that allows for, innovation and creativity to come about. And so I think, I think that's the tough one, right? Because when everyone is the same and, you're all thinking the same and you're not really challenged to make a difference, or to make a change, then it moves very slowly.
Right.
And so we have an opportunity right now. I think people are willing to stand up, but we have to, one of the things that hasn't come up in our discussion tonight is what's preventing that change? And I don't know if that's one of the questions.
Systemic racism,
right? But
which
also,
a lot of people don't even believe exists, which is just, I'm flabbergasted when I hear people say there's no such thing. I'm just like, you're an ostrich if you believe that.
Right. But also we have to call out our academic and STEM industry. Their bureaucratic prescriptive way that's tried and true, and they've figured it all out with regards to the endpoint, they have to go redo that math and say, well, success can look like this if we do this, and then fill it back in, as opposed to projecting out based on the same models and the same typical thought process. And so that's why academic institutions have to be leaders in this. Our philanthropic right. partners have to be leaders in this.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, that they need to make it information available to parents and children what's out there. And not only just the opportunities, but the financial assistance to go along with it. Somebody pointed that in the chat. I forgot to say that. But yeah, I'm just surprised that nobody's heard of certain things out here that I had 50 years ago in Massachusetts, that they're not even being made available to high schoolers out here. So it's very slow. The wheels are turning very slowly. But we're trying, right? This is what this is all about today.
Yeah, thank you, Vera. This is some important points. So we have a couple of hands raised. Patricia, can you unmute your microphone? And I think you had a comment or question.
All right. First, I'll apologize. I pulled over. I'm in my car. So I didn't want to miss it.
We're glad you're safe.
Do that safely.
Years ago, I participated because San Diego had their yearly outreach for kids for STEM. And I do think there are some programs that are trying to encourage kids on the level, like my grandkids, on the level of elementary school and then in high school. I still think there's a discrepancy in materials that are given to sciences. I mean, this harkens back. I'm a person that was raised in the South. And I remember after integration, there were schools that had microscopes, just like we did, but we each had a microscope, where those schools had like two microscopes, because they were people of color, most likely. So I think those programs are increasing, but I wanted to bait you a little bit in that you were saying, for example, NIH has seen that they have a bias, perhaps, in research using male rats, and now they're overcoming that. What about the invisible bias in awarding grants to researchers? In that I saw in the South, there was less research money given to certain labs based upon our location, because, you know, we're all stupid in the South, and based on color. And sometimes even, I mean, my research was done here in San Diego at Scripps Research Foundation, which in the olden days was Scripps Research and Clinic, and I found that just being a woman, if I put Patricia on a study, it was not thought of as high in caliber as if I put P or Patrick, you know. So this is all invisible types of bias. And I wondered if there's any programs. I hate to use the term affirmative action, because that has such a negative connotation now than it did back in the 60s when I was a recent graduate. But how can we overcome? I mean, the idea of starting when we have kids is a great one, and that's ultimately going to be the solution. But now that so much is dependent on money,
right?
Especially in grant awards, how do we look beyond and have programs that are measurable that try to overcome that invisible bias?
As always, Patricia, that's a huge question. But Jeffrey, you think you can handle that?
I always say those things, don't I? The same every year. I get down to the same thing.
So, Jeffrey, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's a big question, and you know, you could pick it apart at many different levels. Indeed, if you look at things like the population of applicants, you know, the pool of applicants in a search, or, you know, how many times someone has to apply for an R01 or a grant, or the grant awardees, the percentage, it's striking that people of color have been pretty much on the outs. And
turned down.
Yes, exactly. And you could say, well, you know, maybe they don't have the goods or what have you. But in reality, it's compounded, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, it's a compounded from all the different things. Maybe they got to their campus and the other senior faculty gave someone else a lot more attention when writing a grant, but they were on their own while they were trying to teach also. Maybe they also were the only Black professor at a university and they were put on 5 different diversity committees because they had to, you know, because they needed to do that while also trying to write grants and do what have you. Maybe not, you know, no one really trying to figure out who they are as a person and their lived experience and why certain things may work one way for them and it may not work the same for another, just in their day to day. These are all some of the things that affect people and their ability to either persist or, you know, not time themselves out, right? But we have to break the cycle. And so I think that there are things that are happening at NIH, but it's slow. But there are definitely things happening, for instance, at NIH that are trying to go after. But we need private funding also. We need philanthropic entities together with nonprofits and community organizations to basically show us the way. I feel like some of the things that, and this is an anecdote, quick anecdote, I went outside of the campus to find out what I could do to help the community. And you might say, wow, but the goal of UCSD should be lifting communities up and changing lives. But in fact, it was my ability to interact with people in the community on their grounds, in their space, that allowed me to see where I needed to be focusing some of these efforts of social justice, of my social justice is interest. Again, back to your question, Michael, I'd love to hear your thoughts also. This is a big one, right? Dealing with tenure, dealing with how do we get more Black and brown faculty in and across our campuses or in the STEM industry. A concerted, deliberate effort with an ability to stay with the question of why is it not changed? If you can sit with that, then you will, and then ask yourself what success looks like and work back. But as soon as that kind of leaves the space, then we're back to our own prescriptive, our goal of X and Y and Z, and, you know, the marginalized just stay marginalized and unseen.
Yeah, I'm not going to say a lot here because I want to get to, we have some other questions, but I mean, the conversation that we're having here today and the things that you've just highlighted, Gentry, and others have highlighted, shows that the words structural and systemic are not merely buzzwords. They are accurate descriptors of something that begins at the earliest stages where resources aren't available in schools for people of color, all the way up to if you've already made it, if you've succeeded and become one of those faces in STEM disciplines, you face hurdles still, hurdles such as having to serve on many diversity committees or whatever else it happens to be. There's extra expected of you. You have to carry more weight on your back in the same race that everybody else doesn't have to. So that's why it's a big problem. But Joed, you had your hand up for quite a while, so I apologize for the time. What did you want to ask?
No, you're fine. It was more towards answering the question. Hi, everyone. My name is Joed Gangmany. I'm a graduating senior, computer science major, mathematics minor from Bellsville, Maryland, by way of Bloom, Cameroon, and I attend Howard University. As you guys can see in my name, I'm part of the CAR STEM Scholars Program, and I'm part of the first cohort. So the question was, would it be better for people of color if people of color were represented appropriately in STEM disciplines, right? And, you know, my major is computer science, so we think a lot in if, you know, if this, then that, or, you know, if else kind of statements. So the way that I break it down is kind of like from the negative, right? So the way that I wanted to phrase my answer was, let's think about the if not, right? If they weren't included. And in order to break that down, right, the way that I thought about it is, psychologically speaking, and I'm sure Mr. Gentry can probably attest to this, everything that anybody does could be a factor, you know, to anything. So even when in medication terms, anything that you do could be a factor for why you shouldn't take it or why it would affect somebody and it wouldn't affect you, right? So psychologically speaking, everything could be a factor. So take two people. two exact same people that, you know, same race, same place, they have the same source of income, go to the same schools and everything like that, with one difference. For example, we were talking in our group about mentorship. I think Nancy was speaking about mentorship, right? Let's say that mentorship is the one place that they differ, right? That one difference in mentorship can tremendously, you know, either increase the person or decrease the person, right? And from my experience, the mentors that I've had have pushed me to the position that I've been in, even though some of my peers back in high school or back in the same locations aren't as fortunate as me, right? And now that's just one singular difference, right? And so that's my answer for that. But if we take that and apply to the broader spectrum of race, for example, people of color, then taking out that whole entire spectrum would be such a detriment. You know, if you look at it from the mentorship example, right, that small little factor is a huge detriment because one person is not able to get the opportunities. If we take it in terms of race and in terms of figuring out STEM problems, taking out that whole group would mean that that whole school of thought, that whole, the whole different intricacies that everybody has, that whole identity, that whole entity would be lost in the STEM field. And those are valuable answers. Those are valuable questions that can be asked. Those are valuable different thought processes that, you know, people can have. Mr. Gentry and I probably can look at the same problem, 1+1, or, you know, a different math problem that's a little bit more difficult, and approach it in different ways. And that's not to say that my way is better or his way is worse, or, you know, but the fact that we have different ways of approaching it is what makes STEM so beautiful. That's what makes science so beautiful. And that's what we lose when we take out a population. And that's why my ultimate answer to the question was an unequivocal yes.
Thank you. Very, very eloquent, very, very good point. So, Gentry, you want to add anything to that?
No, that's spot on. I appreciate that for sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we probably should move on a little bit. I'm going to jump to group 11 on this question. Do you have anything to add? I don't know who's the spokesperson there.
We didn't have a spokesperson, Mike, and you.
And you are it, Arnie. Okay.
Yeah. Well, so we did briefly address it. We spent most of our time on introductions, but I think the two points that we made are the following. One is that you actually threw the fastball to Dr. Patrick earlier when you asked about the issue of fairness. So I stress the issue that the ethical issue here is fairness. The operational issue, Carol Hare brought up, she's a nurse practitioner whom I used to work with the VA for years. And she brought up the fact that that when she was trying to become a clinician, the issue of fairness was that the model was physicians and not nurses becoming primary care clinicians. So that's a similar issue that was both gender, not race-based, but gender and profession-based. We had a student on our group also who is from the East Coast, and I don't know if he's still on, but he actually also had some points to make. I don't see his name. Benjamin Acosta. Benjamin, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think you guys definitely touched on most of it, but like especially the point about the kind of diverse schools of thought, like from different communities that especially Joe had talked about, I kind of talked a little bit about how I've like lived in a lot of places and experienced lots of different kinds of education since my dad was in the military, and kind of seeing how different, like, kind of different, like, the science education is. So, I definitely think that the problem is kind of just kind of encouraging or exposing people in, like, Black communities kind of to science, and once they're exposed, then kind of the diversity of thought will come out, especially.
I do want to thank you for that, Benjamin. I do want to add one thing. Arnold, were you done speaking?
Sorry.
Arnie, did you have anything to add?
No, I've talked enough. Okay. Dr. Patrick.
I want to add one thing, and it just occurred to me, like, we're trying to, we want to be fair, But we're also trying to figure out, you know, why diversity. I mean, Joed just gave a beautiful reason why diversity is a good thing, right? Will be a good thing. And if we don't have it from the negative perspective, if we don't have it, what could happen? But the other thing is, we haven't done the experiment, right? We don't know what the impact of a community can be in science if we don't let them in. So by just saying, well, we've done it this way for 1,000 years and that's, we're going to keep doing it that way, you will be on a fast pace. You know, you're literally working against I mean, my point is really that we don't know what can be because we have not done the experiment. And a priori, we should not say that someone else's, some other group of people, some other human, some diversity of thought, diversity of lived experience won't make a big impact in a field, right? And that takes a lot to say, hey, what we've been doing may not be good enough. I mean, we can see it from the perspective of impacting lives. And I think that the human health is a big one, right? If we can't, you know, and I love the idea that you, doctors and nurses, right? Because, you know, when I see, you know, in the New York Times or an article about black babies dying at 3 times the rate because they're taken care of by white doctors, and we don't know why they're not persisting and not living. But, you know, it's an obvious thing. Well, we need to have more black doctors, right? But also, we still haven't, we haven't done the experiment of including everyone and knowing what that society, what that group brings to the table collectively. And I'll stop there.
Gentry, the statistic you just quoted is a very disturbing one, if I've understood correctly. Has that study been done that's shown that black babies die at 3 times the rate if they have a white doctor than a black doctor?
I'm sure there's a context, but yes, you can find that.
I mean, and as a scientist, I mean, that's a question that's begging to be answered. What's going on there? That's
well. Yes, I think in part, you know, when it's, I talked about communication, trust, you know, I have family members who might not want to take the COVID vaccine because they don't trust, I mean, they don't interact with white people other than when they go to the doctor and then they're talked down to, or they're talked over, or they have inadequate health care, and so they don't trust the system at all. And so from that perspective, that should be enough. That should be enough, right? The fact that we're not, that science is not doing its part to make sure that all lives and black lives matter, right? But also I think that just the fact that we haven't done the experiment. When we include everyone, what does that look like?
So, Arnie, I saw your hand up. We're going to go, but we need to go quickly because I want to get to the last question. So
I'm not sure that it was a matter of white doctors versus black doctors. I think basically black babies and died at, it was black women had a differential access to prenatal care and so forth and so on. That was the basic context of the article. That has to be correct.
Yeah. Thank you, Arnie. That's helpful to know. So we need to move on to the final question. Which basically is where, in a sense, where do we go from here? If the goal is to increase representation of color in STEM disciplines, then who are the stakeholders who can make this change? What can they do? What can you do? Let's give a shot at this. So to room 6, Jose, Kenton, Ray, or Sherry, can you get one of you a spokesperson for your group?
Yeah, so I'm the spokesperson. So yeah, let me introduce myself a little bit.
Hey, Jose.
Hey, Gentry. So my name is Jose Franco. I am a very recent UCSD graduate in mathematics. And so this was a very interesting question, as well as this whole conversation, because I feel from my background, I'm a little bit of like people are talking about me and then I'm also talking about me. So really that perspective, because I identify a lot with what we've been talking about. But I first want to start this question or answer this question a little bit from my perspective and things. We had a little bit of technical difficulties, so we didn't really get too much to talk about this question. But we did bring up a valid point that I'll bring up after I answer from my perspective. So the question is, if the goal is to increase representation of people of color in STEM discipline, then who are the stakeholders? So the perspective I want to bring up is, in a sense, myself. It is the people that are pushing through the system and want to see the diversity increase, and they want to do something about it. And so for me, the way I look at it is I want to see more Latinos, Chicanos, you know, Latinx, that community come into the mathematics part of STEM, because I feel like it's very underrepresented. And so I want to be the representation I want to see, right? Pushing, going through it, because there's a lot that I don't know that I don't know. That question of, I don't know what I don't know. So how am I supposed to fix something if I don't know it is happening to me? And so going through the system, I've noticed a lot of things and I'm like, oh, maybe this is something that's blocking or preventing other people, right? So the state, one of the stakeholders is those people that want to see diversity and also want to do something. So they're pushing through it. And, you know, they don't realize like, oh, these are hurdles. Oh, now that I know the hurdles, when I go, you know, once I make it, whatever that means, I'm going to advocate like, hey, these are hurdles, you know, other people that are going through it and they might not necessarily know that they're hurdles. Let's see. I'm not sure if I fully answered that question. But one thing our group mentioned was potential pushback due to the people that are trying to help and getting pushed back for whatever reasons. And so the way I understood it is, you know, I think there has to be an honest conversation, because, you know, there might be pushback, right? Maybe a possibility is that these students don't necessarily want to do it, right? And they're getting this shoved down their throat, for lack of better terms, right? And so, you know, being open to, there might be pushback, but trying to understand why there's pushback and not, in a sense, use defensiveness. You know, there might be defensiveness initially, but then over time, really just trying to answer like, why is there being so much pushback? And, you know, can we address those issues of why there's so much pushback? From people that are trying to give support. And yeah, that's the gist of everything I had to say. But I do want to say one thing is thank you, Gentry, because without that opportunity, I don't think I would be in the moment in this speaking position. And, yeah.
Thank you very much, Jose. Jose has been an amazing academic coach for the Path Scholars, and very valued member of a Path. So thank you very much.
Yeah, this evening is enriched by, I think, several representatives from your group. Gentry, that's good. Gentry, do you want to further?
I want to, so I was in group 9, but I don't know. Rachel was with me also, right? It was just two of us. The goal is to increase representation of people color in STEM. Who are the stakeholders? That's what we begin to talk about, like things like that. Like the stakeholders are not just the community, but it's also the institutions that have to change. And then I think other stakeholders are just the people that can have an influence. To make a change, like I mentioned, philanthropy. Philanthropy has been one of the biggest partners for me. We have to think it. We think of stakeholders, but think of partnerships also, right? I think philanthropy can play a big part in the type of change that we want to see. And let's see, what else did we come up with, Rachel?
I don't know. know, one thing that kind of stands out to me from our conversation was kind of realizing, you know, there's something beautiful about science being outside of the culture. It doesn't matter who you are or where you come from or whatever. If you, you know, if you can prove your ideas, that's what's important. There's something nice about that, and that's worked very well in many ways for many eons. But it's clear that at this point, it's time for science to evolve for many reasons. It's time to get in context of the world and the culture, and that, yeah, the old ways is not good enough anymore, and we're going to do better the more we recognize the context that we're in and diversify.
Does anyone remember, I think I mentioned in the little recorded portion of the talk early on, I used the word nepotism. And that's not the thing that development and advancement wants me to be saying to philanthropists, but I say, you know, I want to build a program that rivals nepotism, because you can't expect a kid like myself to, from Compton, from Watts, from South Central, or from underserved communities, to have one experience and that should take them the whole way. It's reiterative. How do we learn as humans? We are a part of a community. We learn, if we're a scientist, it's because we learn from scientists. It's not because we sit in a vacuum and we de novo became a scientist. So that's why I think in terms of STEM identity, that, you know, that's something, that's a real big stake that we have to build, right? The STEM identity of individuals, and sometimes that's seeing it from multiple different ways, having not just mentors and advocates, but just experience, learning through failure, right? It should not be my trajectory. If I had gotten off at one point, you know, I wouldn't be here, right? There's many different anecdotes in my life. I only had enough money to apply to one college when I applied to college, and I applied to Berkeley. That's a silly way to apply to college. If you know, when you're going to college, you should apply to a lot of places and not assume you're going to get into Berkeley or Harvard, for instance. But that's what I did, and I got in. So serendipity, luck, and then all the other things that have been a part of my my trajectory, but indeed it's my ability to be sustained is in part what I find within myself and the empathy that I bring to myself to be in this space, even when there are others who don't see me as equal, right? And you know, what that does is it does to begin to break down my own impediment or to be successful, but also it allows me to be a mentor, an advocate, and an example to others.
So it occurs to me, I noticed that we are just about out of time, and I want to note that it's not surprising that in an hour and a half, we feel like we have so much more to do when we're trying to address a problem that has developed structurally and systemically over hundreds of years. But I see many bright lights in the conversation today of things to be done, things that we can do as individuals. But Gentry, I wanted you to be allowed to close this by saying, what would success look like? I guess we won't be able to hear that from the audience as much because of the time, but maybe you can conclude by telling us, what would success here look like?
To me, success looks like definitely more students from underserved Black and brown communities in STEM, but then they become conduits to their community. Success looks like a change in the community that they come from because of STEM. Right now, you could say STEM is a part of the problem of why some of these communities look like they look. We don't want to accept that, but that is the case. And so by increasing the number of students, you know, and having people become much more aware of how they can make a difference, everyone can play a role in diversifying STEM. And sometimes success will have to look like the typical people that are speaking stop speaking. You know, some of the white men that are in the room that are always talking, maybe they let someone else do the talking because maybe they don't have the answer. And, you know, those are the kind of the hard things that it's hard to hear because we build things and we build institutions and they're successful and we can look at them different ways. And, you know, people can value them and we can understand that valuation. But that doesn't mean every member of that community understands that valuation. Right. What about the people who are marginalized in those communities? Right. And it's not just black or brown. It's women. It's LGBTQ. It's everyone who feels like they aren't heard and they're pushing against something. And they keep trying, and that's that empathy for themselves. Like, I keep trying, even though I know that. I think Doc Rivers mentioned at the when Floyd and Doc Rivers of I don't remember what basketball team he coaches for, but he's like, you know, we keep loving America, but they're not loving us back. Sometimes I feel like that in science, and I know that's hard for my colleagues to hear because I'm a successful scientist and I, you know, I'm a great guy. I go to the meetings. You can talk to me easily. But I want my story to be heard also. And it doesn't mean my story. It means the stories of individuals that look just like me. And that's going to take a lot of work. And indeed, we're at the beginning. You will have philosophical arguments about what's the right thing to do from, you know, from here into eternity. But if you start with a place of what does success look like in the context of when everyone's included, when we use things like empathy and compassion as opposed to algorithms, I think we become more of the community and the humanity that we want to see in each other, just like when we're sitting at the table with our own families. And so I'll stop there.
Yeah. Thank you, Gentry. I mean, it occurred to me when you said there could be debates, philosophical debates about what are the best things to do, what should we do? I think there is one answer, though. The wrong thing to do is to do nothing. Once you've recognized the problem, the question is to try what looks best. And if it needs to be an experiment. And as scientists, we should advocate for doing those experiments. As you said, wouldn't it be interesting to see how this community would look different if it was more diverse? So I want to thank you very much for a really interesting talk. I want to thank the audience for just great engagement. I think this was a really helpful discussion. And I also want to thank the audience for giving us an opportunity to see that we have some room for improvement in how we do our structural conversation, but we'll work on that. So thank you, everybody, and join us for upcoming programs. Everybody, this is part of what we want to do, increase the engagement in science and the community. So thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.